question which is posed is Nasata v'nasata be'emuna, were you honest in business? Which is interesting. You'd imagine that with Judaism having so many ritualistic beliefs and how we're supposed to be observant in our Judaism, so that the question of business may come later, but that's not the case. The very first question one is asked about their life was a person honest in business? There are various explanations as to why that may be the case. But perhaps it can be argued that honesty in business may be one of the most efficient ways to truly see the colors of a person. So much of who we are is determined by our upbringing. Our different levels of religiosity can be based on our backgrounds and our social groups. But it's in the business world, when it comes to honesty, that everyone faces the exact same challenges, and everyone can give themselves the same excuses. You know, there are certain areas which are clearly wrong. But we know certain areas of immorality which are wrong, even certain areas of ethics. Clearly going into a store and robbing a store, everyone understands it's wrong. But business ethics covers so many areas which are gray areas, which allow me to convince myself or to justify to myself that I'm an honest person even though I may be acting unhonestly. And again, there are many explanations as to why that would be the first question. But that is the first question. That means that this is perhaps one of the most challenging areas of life and also the most clarifying areas of who we are. Yes?
Could that also apply, say ethics apply to non-Jews?
Yes.
That if we're dealing with them.
Okay, so you ask, yes, ethics is an area where really Jews and non-Jews alike, there would be, it's not ritualistic, there would be this obligation in ethics. But it's important you brought that up because there's a second issue when it comes to ethics I want to point out. And that is discussing religions and different groups of people. So there would be the understanding that when it comes to ethics, there really is no need or connection to one's belief in God. Regardless whether it's Jewish belief, non-Jewish belief in God, but this is really an area where an agnostic or an atheist would also agree to the fact that business ethics is important to make sure the world runs smoothly. And while that is true, as Jews, part of the Jewish belief is that even areas which we can justify logically, we also follow because God said so. And when a Jew studies the Torah, and there are laws of ethics in Torah, it talks about do not steal. In the Torah, we recognize that when I choose not to steal, or when I choose to behave ethically, I'm not only doing so because through this I am going to cause human harmony, but I'm also doing so because this is what God wanted, and this is how I remain connected to God. And without delving too far into this idea, when one has a godly reason to behave ethically, it'll create a much stronger commitment to that, as opposed to one is doing it simply because that is what's right for mankind. There are all sorts of ways that can be, when one can be misled in justifying what's best for mankind. Today's topic, so the six topics which we will discuss during the next 6 weeks, again, each week we have a guest speaker. Again, thank you to Mr. Schluss for joining us today. The next 6 weeks, the six topics, the first is today, the ethics of insider trading, the wages of the working poor. The third topic would be the ethics of debt discharge. The right to organize, to bargain collectively, and to strike. That would be the fourth discussion. The fifth discussion is the ethics of CEO compensation. And the sixth topic would be another side to business ethics, basically freeloading, going into a store with no intention to buy it. Various interesting topics related to freeloading. That will be class number six. It's important to point out that today's discussion, as well as all the discussions, is not only relevant to corporations and lawyers and those involved in the business world. Many of these topics, all of these topics in a certain way, are connected to any individual in the way they live their life, regardless of if they are in this industry or not. And therefore it's important, specifically as we will see today's topic. What is the purpose of this course? What are we going to accomplish? So, there are three central objectives to this course. The first is to understand some key principles which guide Jewish business ethics. Understand what are the principles in Jewish business ethics. Secondly, it's to demonstrate that Torah talks in real-world concerns. Torah affects our life. They talk about people who are in a hot air balloon which went off course, and they swayed towards the ground. No idea where they were, and then they got near the ground. They yelled out to someone. They said, "Sir, do you know where we are?" And the man answered, "You're in a hot air balloon." And with that, they drifted out further, and they were furious. One man said, "That must have been a Hebrew teacher." He said, "Why?" He said, "Because what he said was true, but it was irrelevant." So the idea is that many times you think of Torah, of course it's true, it's the Torah of truth, but it's irrelevant. So therefore, we're going to point out how the Torah's messages are very much relevant. And we will understand, hopefully appreciate the logic and the compassion embedded within the ethics of Torah. What it is not, and it's important to point out, this is not a halachic course. In other words, we are not going to necessarily come to clear rulings. In other words, one shouldn't walk out of this class with a clear directive of what should or should not be done. And when one comes to a question in an ethical decision, one should consult a common rabbi. Not all rabbis are familiar. This is a specific area and the area of ethics, and you should consult the competent rabbi where, for the right price, you could probably get the answer you want. This is not a halakhic course. It will give us a brief overview and understanding of the ethics of Jewish business ethics, and hopefully we'll appreciate that. One last thought before we dive into this topic, and that is, and this is important, the topics, all six topics, are very much connected to political issues which come up, and as the next, in the coming year, they're going to become more and more pronounced as we have the divide between the left and the right and different feelings and opinions on it, and there's a certain habit that we have, a certain frame of mind that I follow, a certain path I consider myself to be one way or another, and then whenever a topic comes up, I naturally align that topic to my beliefs, which I already set in place. So if I am, yeah, I'm a Democrat or a conservative or a liberal, so I will, without necessarily looking at it objectively, I will look at it from my perspective that is already set in place. And this is a mistake. When it comes to Torah, we have to try to remove ourselves from our political stand in any area and see it simply as a Jew and the Torah perspective. It's not necessarily easy. You know, they say the story about the previous Rebbe, the previous Chabad Rebbe, Rav Yossi Yitzchak Schneerson, passed away in 1950, and he was in Russia. Before he moved to America, he was in Russia, and at one point, during the whole movement of change, communism, socialism, so he was traveling on a train, and there were a few people there, and he was a leader. A few people there who wanted to hear from him, what is the Torah's view on socialism? And again, this was at a time where it wasn't clear exactly what would be. And they were expecting an answer, what's the Torah's view? And the previous Rebbe's response was, there are good things in socialism and there are good things in the opposite system. The good things in both systems are clear in the Torah. The Torah, instead of aligning the Torah to one approach, we could find the good within every system has good. And the Torah has the roots of good for all systems that may be. With that, we will move into today's topic, the topic of insider trading, which we've heard about. And let's open with text number one. Again, the way we do this is we go around the room from person to person reading the text. You are welcome to pass if you'd rather not read it. But we will begin on page number 2, text number 1, regarding business ethics. Insider trading, and... Alright, sorry. Whenever you're ready.
Next one?
Yep.
One fascinating expression of this approach is found in the laws of vows. The Mishnah states that the person who vows not to obtain any benefit from another person, then he is forbidden both to sell to and also to buy from debtors. The assumption is that in a normal transaction, both sides benefit. In the language of economists, there is both consumers,
okay, so the idea is that ideally buying and selling should benefit everyone. And we talk about the market. The stock market is an area of buying and selling. And just because one is buying and one is selling, it doesn't mean that one has to be happy and one unhappy. Ideally, when one buys and one sells, whether it's an item, whether it's with stock, it's something that everyone should or could be happy about. Now, the discussion of insider trading is unique because, as was mentioned earlier, insider trading only became, in a sense, illegal or was clear, it was more clarified in the mid-30s. I believe it was somewhat a response to the stock market crash in 1929. We felt a lot of that had to do with different problems of insider trading and the like. Beforehand, there was an opinion, which today there are those which still have, which felt that this is actually an efficient way to do business, that certain people know when you buy and you sell, and I'm buying based on information I think will help. Obviously, since the 1930s, it is illegal. And today, we will discuss a little bit from the Torah perspective. But the point is, even from the American legal perspective, it wasn't always that clearly defined as wrong and evil. This is something which is relatively recent. Let's analyze this case today, based on on what we mentioned earlier, the case of Martha Stewart. Some of you may have seen this video. I did send it out in the email. Some of you may not. We'll play it again.
Good things are a signature of Martha Stewart Living. It is a simple, clever shortcuts and solution that make everyday living just a little easier.
Known as the most famous homemaker in America, Martha Stewart transformed entertainment in the home into a worldwide media empire. With a daily TV show, her own book, and countless publications, Stewart became a billionaire when the company went public in 1993. 2 years later, Stewart's star had lost some of its charm when she was accused of insider trading.
Indicted on criminal charges related to an insider trading scandal that began more than a year ago.
If she's convicted of all these charges, she faces up to 30 years in prison and $2 million in fines.
During the investigation, the following story emerged. Martha Stewart's close friend, Sam Waxel, was CEO of Enron, a biotech company that produced anti-cancer drugs. When Waxel learned that the Food and Drug Administration was about to reject him, cancer drug, Erbitux. He called his stockbroker, Peter Vukanovic. Vukanovic was on vacation, so Waxel spoke instead to his assistant, Doug Fannin, and instructed him to sell Waxel's income stock. Fannin contacted Vukanovic and explained the situation. Vukanovic, who was also Martha Stewart's broker, told Fannin to call Stewart and tell her that income's share price was likely to drop, because Waxel was cashing out. Fannin did so, and Stewart sold all of her Enron shares one day before the announcement of the FDA's rejection. As expected, when the news became public, Enron shares declined sharply. Had Stewart not sold, she would have lost almost $46,000. These losses were now distributed among the people who bought the shares that Stewart sold to a market ignorant of the FDA's upcoming decision. Were Martha Stewart's actions ethically wrong? You be the judge.
All right, so on page number 3, the question which was just posed, those who'd like, we did have weren't perhaps able to follow all the technicalities. On page number 3, you do have the case exactly as it was. You can go over it again. And perhaps hear some opinions. Were Martha Stewart's actions ethically wrong? If so, what exactly was ethically wrong about them? And if not, how would you defend her against such charges? Now, remember, in this case, perhaps we should also clarify, there were several people involved. And maybe if you have different opinions regarding the different people, there was the owner of the CEO of the company Imclone, who sold his stock. And then there was also the agent, Waxel, I'm sorry, there was the agent, Vukanovic, who shared the information with Martha Stewart. It's really three different people, and you could argue three different circumstances which of their actions. So again, perhaps you can share, people share your opinions on this matter, if you feel right or wrong. Yes, please.
I think it was legally wrong, but the legal system would say it was wrong. Right?
When you say, you're saying that in general with all the people mentioned in this story, in this episode.
That they're probably legally thoughtful.
Okay.
I don't know about the ethics, except that we have a commandment about if you're You have to have a legal system.
Okay. All right. Okay.
And you're through the laws, so on that demanded basis, if you're not adhering to the laws of the country, then that makes you allowed to leave forever.
Okay. But question. You're starting your own country. You went on a ship and you discovered a new land. You're about to start it. Now, how do you feel about the story? And the first three people in the country, the story happened to them. So, how would you feel? And it's true, what you said is a very good point, but in your understanding of right and wrong, do you feel any differently than what you just said? You just quoted American law as well as Torah law, but do you feel one way or another on your own?
I think it's unfair.
Unfair, okay, yes.
It kind of depends if she doesn't clarify here, I don't know the details of the case, I don't remember them, but if her broker is going to assume a good person calling you as your fiduciary and tells you that he knows some information that would benefit you to sell your shares, and she assumes that Waxell was her friend, and if she had information that Waxell seems to be a virtuous person, how did she not know if that was public information? So this does, I don't know the real details, but
okay.
If she knew that it was public information, if they used the...
I mean, if she knew that it wasn't public information.
In between persons so they would get around helping to spread this kind of an arrangement that they previously had, if she would have known that information, and this was just a vehicle to accomplish something illegal, then it was wrong. But if the broker called...
I think she didn't know.
...it had been private information, and she assumes all the parties she works with are ethical...
Okay. All right. Yeah.
So there's a saying that often a tip is either illegal or it's wrong. So if you get a tip, it's wrong.
Okay. All right.
It's almost goes to what she said. If Martha Stewart, the broker or the people she was talking to, did not say, just said, trust me, without giving her a reason, would that make a difference?
Okay. I mean, I don't know the exact circumstance. I imagine if someone comes to you and says, sell everything right now, it's a unique circumstance. I don't know, but it's a unique circumstance which indicates that there is something unusual going on and you wouldn't simply sell. You would want to know why, and it doesn't seem anybody else is selling. I don't know exactly what happened. Yes?
It seems to me that Martha Stewart is not stupid. The billionaires. Experience.
Yeah.
And guy calls her and says, the guy who owns the company is cashing out. I mean, the CEO is cashing out. Wouldn't your person ask the question, well, what's going on? Why is the guy who owns the company cashing out?
Okay.
You know, is the company going out of business?
All right. All right. 1 second. Just get around. Go ahead. Okay. So you said this guy, his name is Bakanovic, he did the right thing by notifying her and giving her the ability to show. Okay. But just a question, because again, there are going to be several cases we're going to analyze. Yeah, go ahead. Yes.
How would you maybe lost an answer? With interest rates being so low and stock prices being so low, many times we hear certain companies are buying back their shares, and you hear that, and they say, "Don't the company corporations buy back their shares?" It's a good sign that they think that their price of their stock is undervalued.
All right.
Now, aren't they making decisions about
their shares based on inside information about their own company, and they're buying them back? So you rely on that company to buy back. How are they making that decision? They have more information than the company. Yeah, but you can look at what they're raising on this valuation. Presumably that they feel, based on valuation, Have to, what they fill out, I guess, a form 10B5, which is
the SEC form that basically says all material, public, all material information about the company has been disclosed. And then the government has to insert that. So it's very specific rules about what you have to do.
All right, but effectively you are selling it to someone. You're selling that house to someone who in a day from now the house is going to be burnt down. They're not aware of that fire coming. And that's the question. Now, an argument to that would be that they may be buying it anyways. But the point is that someone may be buying it anyways. It doesn't change the fact that I know this is going to be damaged, and I'm giving something which will be damaged to someone at much more than it's. This is the topic. I want to go and move forward. We'll have a chance to express these opinions again. Yes.
Did the broker
get penalized in any way? Yes, absolutely. And that's where there's another point here. Let's just quickly go through some of the typical problems which are generally explained why insider trading is wrong. There's a certain, the most perhaps the simple explanation is it's unfair that someone can buy and sell based on information they know which other people don't know. Then there's something very important here. This Sam Waxel, he was the CEO of this company. And one can argue that someone who's an insider in the company has an obligation to the shareholders of that company. They have to look out for the well-being of the shareholders as an insider in the company. That's part of their obligation. And in that sense, perhaps what he did was far worse because he contributed to the detriment of the company, which is his shareholders, those who invested in him, placing trust in him to act on their best behalf. Martha Stewart is someone else. That is, it's a different circumstance where she wasn't responsible to anyone other than herself. At the same time, you can say she caused someone to purchase things which she knew was valued far less than what she actually sold it for. There's another discussion that perhaps information is really not, you can actually steal information. And information that doesn't really belong to you and you use it is stealing information. On text number two, in page number four, text number two, I don't want to read this outside because I don't know how important it is to the topic of discussion. I'm going to give a moment. It just points out that there's a certain lack of clarity within the legal movement as to how insider trading should be dealt with. So take a moment to read text number two. It's somewhat complicated. I don't want to get into it. And as I see, there's lots of opinions on the matters that you're going to talk about, so we'll have to, unless people are interested in staying here till midnight, we'll try to keep things moving along. Okay. So what I'm about to say may be somewhat of a letdown, and that is as follows. What is the Jewish law regarding insider trading? And the truth is that if you look in response to insider trading, the whole topic is a relatively recent topic. And if you look in rabbinic responsa, there's very little to say on this topic. And the reason is as follows. As Dr. Rubin mentioned earlier, in Judaism there's an important rule, and that is called Dina Dimalchuta Dina. The law of the land, of the governing land, is law. Now this is a complicated topic, which we will actually talk at length about in class number three, which is about bankruptcy. But suffice to say that Dina de Malchusa Dina, the law of the land is law. Torah gives value to the law of the land, is very much relevant when it comes to business. And when it comes to insider trading, there's no doubt that the law of the land would be law. Therefore, we are bound to whatever law there is. So therefore, it's not being that it's a recent topic. And to analyze it in depth is something which would be somewhat irrelevant because regardless of what the conclusion would be, you'd have to follow the law of the land. So therefore, there isn't any clear black and white answer from a Torah perspective of whether it is legal or illegal. However, what we will do today is we're going to go on a theoretical journey of imagine, as we said before, there is no law of the land. There is a new land. And we would like to determine the law based on Torah values, Torah business ethics. What would be the law based on certain other principles in Judaism? And that's what we're going to do today. We're going to learn some rules in Torah regarding fraud. And that's the question is, insider trading, is it fraud? So we will learn some Torah laws, interesting laws regarding fraud, and from there perhaps we will try to come to some sort of conclusion with regards to insider trading. We will open with a case study. with regard with the case study from Cicero, which can be, again, several case studies we'll have, which we will be able to compare those cases with, at the end, with insider trading. Case study on page number 5. And let's do this.
Yes, it is.
Go ahead.
In effect, hold the stake in the sale. Case study number 2. Suppose that an honest man wants to sell a house because of certain defects of which he alone is aware. The building is supposed to be quite healthy, but in fact, it's sanitary, and he is aware that it is. Or the voice of the man is falling down, but nobody knows this except the owner. Suppose he does not disclose these facts to the purchasers and sells the house much more than he expected. Has he behaved unfairly or dishonestly? Certainly he has an
antipater. Sorry, that's just Antipater.
Whatever it is. An ant does not consider a man right when he has lost his way, is penalized by general
execration.
What's that, execration?
Yeah.
And it's not precisely the same thing to let a purchaser make a mistake and ruin himself with a very heavy loss. That is even worse than not showing a man the way, since in this case the purchaser is being deliberately misled. But he did not force you to buy, did he? Objects Diogenes. He did not even ask you to. He offered for sale something he did not want. You bought something that you wanted. For when the purchaser can exercise his own judgment, what fraud can be there for the seller? It would surely be exceptionally stupid of a seller to enumerate the defects of what he is selling and the height of the certainty for the auctioneer to proclaim at the owner's question of the sale. This is a sanitary house.
All right.
This whole thing is baloney.
All right, how do you feel about it?
Well, this is baloney.
Which way?
The guy is illegal. It's illegal to sell a home knowing that there's defects in it.
Okay. All right. Okay. Is there anyone who? All right. Let's just quickly gain a general feeling of how people feel regarding this. Who has the more compelling argument, the Agonies or Antipater? All right. Go ahead.
I see the Diogenes argument because I think that the person wanting it may want it for a completely different purpose. He may just be interested in the land. So it's all.
In which case you have a situation where you say the house is uncentered. That's the right thing.
Wait, remember the argument of the Agonies. That's interesting what you're bringing up.
The point I'm making is that the value to the seller is he may, in his own mind, be misleading the buyer. The buyer may, in effect, end up turning that piece of property into something far more valuable with the amount that he's paying with information or an idea that he has. So he's going to opt. You know what? I got to tell you, it may be consensus, but I want it because this is far more valuable.
So you think each one may have information? All right, go ahead. Let's hear Lisa, go ahead. Okay, all right, go ahead.
I have to first preface this by saying the irony of Diogenes who walked around with a lantern searching for someone who would see the truth, who was honest, that this Diogenes says that we veil this honesty.
Perhaps it's not that, because Diogenes approaches things from a perspective of truth, and therefore he's saying there is what's kind, but what's true, and I'm supposing his argument, saying what's true is that I never asked, the owner said, I never asked you to buy it. When you purchased it, I didn't tell you what, if you would have asked me whether there's a problem here, I would have had to answer right. I can't lie, but by not giving information which you didn't ask for, he said, as far as truth is concerned, I haven't done anything wrong. I may not have been the most, the kindest person.
Okay, I would say that's the difference between facts and truth. Because if we're actually looking at ethics as being what is for the greater good, then what that woman said about bringing harm to someone's, the insanitary condition in a home it could be lethal, as opposed to wallpaper that can stick on the walls and it's going to fall off and you're going to have to end up painting it and scraping it, which I think is a different, that's an annoyance rather than you actually can damage the health of the family.
Okay, so let's quote this just a little bit differently, and that would be, suppose the buyer purchases the home, and a week later he comes back and he says, I'd like to have my money refunded. So yeah, so we've all come, seems to be pretty, across the board, people feel it's unkind, but does the buyer then have the right to say, I'd like to have my home returned, I'd like to have my money returned to me? There's just an assumption that the house would seem to be healthy. He didn't say anything. We see, you go to a house from all perspectives. Again, so regarding this question, does he have the right to then demand his money back? You would say so. Okay, well, let's go into the...
I have one more question.
Yes.
What does this Talmud say about the inverse of this? What if someone buys something and discovers treasure?
We're going to get to that.
Okay.
All right, so we have these two approaches here from the two students, or the two people that Cicero brings out. I don't know if they were students. And let's see what the Torah is. Because over here, in this circumstance, Torah definitely has a very concrete statement to say. Text 3a, this is from Maimonides, codifying the works of Talmud into a very clear legal work. Where are we at? Please, Dr. Ron.
A person is forbidden to act in a smooth tongue and luring manner, saying one thing outwardly and thinking otherwise in one's heart. It's forbidden to deceive people. One should not press a colleague to share a meal when one knows that the colleague will not accept the invitation, nor should one press presence upon a colleague knowing that the colleague will not accept them. The same applies to all matters of this sort.
See, this is unique. The idea of theft applies to gnevas da'at. That's what we're going to talk about, theft of mind. That you are being dishonest, you're stealing their thoughts, and the example he gives, their strength, says you shouldn't invite someone knowing they will not come. In other words, inviting someone with the truth, never intending to have this person over. I truly don't intend to have this person over. I invite them, and I know they're going to say no. If they say yes, I'm in trouble. And therefore, he says that's gnevas da'at, deception. Okay? And it's illegal. It's wrong. The theft is not only of monetary objects, but it's of da'at as well. Let's continue this, because let's talk about, practically speaking, how this applies to buying and selling. Text 3b.
It is forbidden to trick people in commerce or to deceive them. For example, if merchandise is blemished, one must inform the consumer. Likewise, one should not sell a Gentile not kosher meat, as if it were kosher.
This is from the Shulchan Aruch, who lived, Rabbi Yosef Karo, lived about 500 years ago, and he brought the works of the Torah giants before him into one clear, decisive book of law, Rabbi Yosef Karo. And he writes the following. He says you can't deceive someone. The example he gives is actually not necessarily that similar to the one on the board, because one should not sell a Gentile non-kosher meat. The point here is that even though it's the same meat, and the Gentile has no obligation when it's not harming to say, obviously it's a Jew to sell non-kosher meat when he assumes it's Jew, when he assumes it's kosher, is a problem. But for the non-Jew, there is no obligation for kosher. Even so, it's prohibited because you are deceiving them, you are what's called stealing their knowledge, stealing their wisdom. This is gnevas da'at, and even though it may be the same, they, for whatever reason, want to have kosher meat, and therefore you cannot give them non-kosher food under the guise that it is kosher. So this is the rule of gnevas da'at, as you see on the top of the rule. That is the first law in which we are mentioning today, is intent to deceive. There is a second form of deception, and this is without intent. What if it is unintentional? So instead of talking about someone who intends to deceive someone, then there is the mekasas, a mistake in sale, which is slightly different. Text 3c describes what is a mekachtos. Go ahead, please.
When a person sells a colored real estate or movable property, if the defect of property is was not aware, it may be returned, even to several years have passed, for the transaction was concluded under the erroneous sentence. The above applies provided the buyer did not use the purchase article after discovering the blemish. If, however, it was used after the blemish was discovered, the buyer surpassed the right and the just may not return the act.
Okay, so here's an example where the buyer and the seller, they weren't aware. This wasn't done intentionally. But there is what's called a mekapta, a mistaken sale. And this is an unusual example, but theoretically, you know, someone who sleepwalks or sleep talks, and you have a business transaction with them while they're asleep. So there was no conscious decision of what to do. Obviously, such a sale would be disqualified. So the Talmud tells us that there is another circumstance, which is that a person is not aware of what they're truly buying or selling, then that wasn't a true decision on the buyer or seller's part. So if a person intends to choose a green shirt, and when the item comes, it's a white shirt. Now, over here, several things. First of all, the company may have not done it intentionally. Secondly, the white shirt may be as valuable as the green shirt. It's not a matter of a defect. It's just a matter that it's different than what the purchaser thought they were buying. Over here, too, the sale can be overturned. An example of this would be, there's a recent and interesting case, which is right now in court. There was a divorce which happened years ago between a man named Mr. Simpkin and his wife, or his ex-wife, who's now Mrs. Blank. Now, they were extremely wealthy, and they split everything appropriately, and then he contacted her and he'd like to revisit that contract, renew the contract. Why? So this has a lot to do with the Ponzi scheme of Bernie Madoff, because a lot of the owner, a lot of the, from the end of split, they had a lot invested in that company, and he took most of that investment for himself. In exchange, gave her millions of dollars of cash or items of equity, which the law, that value. Now, after it becomes clear that all of that investment was a fraud, didn't really exist. So he argues that contract was a mekapta. I don't know if he says those words. But he argues that it's a mekapta. It was a mistake. We weren't truly aware of the circumstances. This is in court today. It's a major issue today. And I don't think they've come to a clear decision. The decision is pending. But this will be an example where the sale or the contract was done without knowledge. It was a mistake. Even though there was no intent. We have the example of an intentional mistake, which is called kneva das. But then even when there's no intent, there is the mekapas, the mistaken sale. No, this is a secular, not a Jewish court. This is something, I think it's in California, where this is being analyzed right now. Alright, so on page number 8, let's just go through somewhat of a chart to clarify what we've said until now. And that is that, based on the laws of deception and mistaken sales, how would Jewish law rule in the case of the defective house? We say, Nevas Da, the steps of mind, the intent of the seller, and any action done with intent to deceive. Mekaktos, mistaken sale, has to do with the nature of the sale, any sale in which there isn't complete knowledge, even without intent to deceive, and even if it's not a different value. But I was expecting something else. Based on these two rules, how would Jewish law rule in the case of the defective house? Any opinions on this? Is the sale, can the purchaser go back and request a refund? Yes, he can. Absolutely, Judaism, they can. We would follow the opinion of Ansipater. Now, we was mentioned before, what about the buyer? So, what about the seller? What if the seller is not aware of what the seller sold? So there's an interesting video clip. I think this is also very recent. The case which just came up. Let's see if this will work.
I'm shocked. Believe me, Animal, many have gotten her hands on an original by one of the greatest artists ever.
Taisha McNeil bought this painting at a garage sale for just $2. I was going to hang it up here. She was about to hang it in a mobile home when she noticed the sign of the picture had Pablo Picasso's name on it.
It has his name on it. It says Pablo Picasso. The colors, the bright colors, is kind of different. The way that the artist did it, it just kind of caught my eye.
The search for stolen Picasso's McNeil called the FBI officials, now trying to determine if it's a real Picasso. McNeil said if it is, she will definitely sell it. And who can play over that?
You say.
Thank you.
that's how we make a dollar.
All right. So, obviously, this is in America. I can't imagine there's any rule which would force her to return that item to the owner. It's interesting because as I was preparing for this course and I looked at this book, I also noticed in the corner it says Pablo Picasso. So I'm going to look into that too. But the all right. So here we have the a very interesting Torah perspective that this Mekah Tov, the idea of an unknown, a mistaken sale, applies for the seller as well. Let's read this text 3D on page number 9.
If the buyer purchases an item that has a hidden value of which the seller is unaware, like an antique, the buyer must inform the seller that this object is worth more than the average similar object on the market. One must do so due to the prohibition against deception. Furthermore, it would appear that if the buyer did not inform the seller, the item sold is different than the item of the seller intended to sell, and the sale can be nullified as a mistaken sale.
Okay, so this mistaken sale, again, following the same rules of logic, the sale has to be done with the awareness of the buyer and the seller of what is being purchased and what is being sold. Yes?
But in this case, neither is aware.
That's a good point.
Not aware.
That's right. But so there was a lack of knowledge from both sides. So the point is that had they been aware, it would have been sold for far more, which is why there's a small, important qualification here. The person knows they're selling an antique object, and they don't know exactly how old or how rare it is, then this wouldn't apply. Because then becomes the obligation of the seller. You know that it's an antique. You know that this is a Picasso. So you have to find out and sell it appropriately. If you know that it's Picasso and you choose to sell it based on negligence, because you didn't look into it properly, then the sale would go through. Then everyone would agree that the sale would qualify. Here, there's a lack of knowledge at all, so then it's called a Mecca Fest. Yeah?
There's a story in the book that a gentleman years ago goes and visits her to buy a camel. This is for the person who took back the camel to get jewels and things and sends the servant the book, got a great deal. And he ends up sending the servant back to pay a gentleman for the jewel that he got from the camel for that.
Okay, maybe this is a story in the Talmud. I mean, that case, not exactly sure the specifics, but then that goes into a whole different discussion. Was part of the stipulation that the cover would be on the camel or not? Or perhaps that was a mistake. That could be Ashava Saveda, returning a lost object, which is something else. But yeah, that would fall into the same category of not being aware of what was sold. But if here, typically an antique would be the best example of something which I see it, but I have no idea of what its true value is. And the buyer, too, can then go to the seller, can go to the buyer and say, you have to return this to me, because it was a Mekah Tov, it was a sale with mistaken knowledge. Yes?
It seems that the thread that from the beginning with Martha Stewart to this example is knowledge, that the key on all of this is, for culpability, is what your knowledge or awareness of the fact.
Okay. We're going to get to that. We're going to save that really for the end when we try to apply it all. Yes.
Does the, let's say that we find out that this painting was a stolen painting.
There is a rule in Talmud which is Hagonev min Haganav Vase, that one who steals from a thief, it's still prohibited. Now, if you know that someone's a thief, you're not allowed to steal that item from them, which probably would apply here too. If we know that they're a thief, so then we go to the original owner and we'll give it back to the original owner.
I don't think this person's a thief.
Well, listen, there's a lost item. Okay, let's move to a third principle. So we have such a principle of intent to deceive, the principle of mistake and fail, and then there's a third principle called Ona'a. And this is based on a very clear prohibition in Torah, text 4a from the book of Leviticus. Mrs. Luger, please. You're up. Oh. Okay, you're going to have to have her in mind when you read this. Page number 10.
When you make a purchase to yourself or make a purchase in the land of yourself, you shall not wrong one another.
All right, that's pretty broad. You shall not wrong one another. Lo al tonu isha san miso. The term tonu, you see the word on the board is onah, comes from the root Tony. We're going to keep this here until everyone is extremely hungry. So the Tony is on us, trickery. So we have, what is trickery? So this is why we talked about how the oral Torah and the written Torah are necessary, combination. You can't read the written Torah and understand it without the Talmud, the oral tradition, explaining what it means. What is trickery? Well, the rabbis established on page 4b, what is trickery regarding overpricing an object. Text 4b on page number 10. Go ahead.
Less than a stick, the sale is by me. More than a stick, the sale is by me, and we do not refund it.
All right. Anybody can suggest, anybody has a venture or guess as to what is the sixth which is being referred to? What is the sixth?
The
sixth of profit and sixth of
normal
selling price. That's different. We have where sixth of profit and sixth of selling price. The truth is, Torah has no problem with profits and with making profit over items. And the sixth over here is a reference to the market value. Alright, so based on that, it's the market value, yes.
What is the market value? Everything is bargained for.
Okay. We are referring to something which specifically has a market value. And I actually went over this topic, this course, with my father, who's obviously more knowledgeable in these areas, and he said that, he explained to me how today the idea of a clear market value is less and less defined than it used to be. It used to be things were very clearly defined. In times of the Talmud, there was rice, there was cotton, things had their very clear value. Today, with the free market, it is hard, or many items don't have a very clear market value. Sometimes they do. You know, sometimes things do have a clear market value. Could be items, could be bulk items, in huge amounts, so there's a market value. Perhaps even food items. Sometimes if there is a very clear market value, that's when the rules of Onah apply. If there is no market value, then you're right. Then this wouldn't apply. Then we would only have the previous two issues.
Does this apply to underselling it, like a loss leader for a company? Like loss leader get you in the market or whatever?
No, sir. This is generally discussing overcharging for an item, an unsuspecting customer.
But
so you go, sorry?
But not undercharging.
I think undercharging would also, but that's generally overcharging, because the person who's charging should know they have an obligation to know what they're selling. So over here you have just to explain what that was, you have it's less than a sixth of the market price, above the market price, the sale is valid. If it is exactly a sixth, then the rule is the sixth is returned and the sale is valid. So theoretically, if you have two people selling and one sells it for less than a sixth, then they keep that added, let's say they sell for an eighth above market value. So they keep the eighth, and the person who sells it for a sixth ends up losing the entire sixth. And if it's sold for over a sixth, then the whole sale is canceled, and this is the rule of Onah, this is trickery. So, in other words, there's a more modern term for this prohibition, text 4C, by Rabbi Aaron Levine. So you're going to pass, okay? Dr. Wakansky, please.
A law prohibits an individual from concluding a transaction at a price that is more favorable to himself and competitive than the law prohibits complaints or rebates that a better market price opportunity was available to the client at the time he entered into the transaction. He can use the following complaint and opportunity cross claim. Complaints and complaint does not lose his right to transact in the market unless he is certain that he waived this right at the time he entered.
So every customer has the right to have the item they're purchasing be within the realm of the market norm. And within a sixth is considered the market norm, and the purchaser, so to say, is giving that for that the seller may be selling it a little bit more, at least a sixth more, than the market norm of that. So let's move along, because we still have some more cases to analyze to get to some sort of conclusion. Applying the different principles we've said before. So we're going to, the first two principles of Mekach Tov, Mistake and Fail, and Gneva Das, we're going to consider that both a mistake and a fail, because they both really are. Whether it's a known defect, which I'm hiding, or it's an unknown defect, it's the same principle. The person doesn't know what they're purchasing. And then there's price one, and we're going to see that not everything applies to both. All right, so an undisclosed defect in an item that has a set market value, the defect significantly lowers the item's value. So over here you have both a mess-up stuff, it's a mistake and a fail, as well as the price problem. It's worth a lot less, and the purchaser doesn't know what they're getting. The second is an undisclosed defect that doesn't lower an item's value. Say the color is different, and you presented it as one color and a different color. So then, it is a mistaken sale, it's not price drop, because the price has not gone down. An undisclosed defect in an item that has no set market value, again, it is a mistaken sale, so there's no price fraud, so as we said, when there's no market value, there can't be price fraud. An overpriced, flawless item that has a set market value. So over here, there's no mistaken sale, because I know exactly what I'm getting. I'm simply overpaying for it. That's where there's a no, even though I know exactly what I'm getting, there's no mistake. And finally, charging an exorbitant sum for a flawless item that has no set market value, market price, would not be mechatzos, because I don't know what it is, because I know exactly what I'm purchasing, and there would not be price fraud, because there is no set market value for this. And interesting, we follow the natural, when we talk about what is a defect, we have to follow what is typically considered a defect. Question raised, maybe we can do a little survey here. There's a question raised in the news. Would people purchase a house if they knew that someone was murdered in that house? Should we do a little survey? Would this concern people? So interestingly, there are differences in the state of New York and in California. In New York, it is not considered a defect that people really would be concerned about. Therefore, there's an obligation to notify the purchaser that someone was murdered in that house. In California, however, the rule states that a person must share that information. And if you can say that the laws of the state reflect the opinions of the people there, what that basically is telling us is that in this area, this defect is considered a defect which most people find problematic. So that's how we would follow when it comes to defects. We follow the typical person living in that area. I don't know what the rule would be in Michigan. Maybe in Detroit, a little different than the suburbs. All right, so he's going back to the defective house. There's Ne'asas, there's Nechasas. Again, no, it depends on if the defect changes the value of the house. All right, case study. Now we're going to move on to case two, which seems to be very similar to insider trading. Now I skipped several texts, and the purpose of these texts is to point out that if someone clarifies that this house has such and such an issue, and then they purchase it, for whatever, you know, as soon as something is clarified, or if I make a condition, that I'm selling to you knowing there's a problem with the foundation, then, and the person accepts that, then that condition is accepted. You can't say, well, the house looks fine, and now we discussed this. We discussed that there may be an issue. Yes. If the, it would seem that if the...
If they rely on you.
Right, no, well... But if the well... There is something called as is. You know, on eBay today, you can sell something as is. And this is an area where I still have to find out more about. As I was preparing this, it seems that as is is not that clear. When I say, are you buying this as is? So on the one hand, you can say the purchaser is purchasing it as is. But on the other hand, the purchaser is still assuming that it's fine. The Talmud talks about if you clarify the problem, then of course it's okay. But this area of selling it as is, in other words, I'm saying that there may be a problem, is that okay or not? That's something which I'm sorry? Well, there could be I don't know about houses, when you talk about on eBay, for example, where a person saying as is, they're clearly saying, there may be an issue. I'm not selling this to you with the assumption that it's fine. There may be an issue, but still, the question is that still considered a mistaken sale or not? And perhaps an inspection would go under that category as well. When I say inspection, but if I know there's a problem, I have to let you know that problem. Then the inspector doesn't find it, I still have an obligation. Again, this would be different, perhaps, than what the law is here. That would seem to be the law. So there is certainty that a person can make conditions, as we said in text number, text number five, the call hamasne bedavar shevamamam snoi kaim. All stipulations in monetary matters are valid. So I can make a condition. I'm selling it to you, and I'm charging you an extra fifth of what it's worth. Well, then I'm clearly saying what I'm doing, and a person's paying an extra fifth, which is onah, but we established that. And then that's okay. Yes? Oh, you still have to. So all three, really. Wow, so you see, it's pretty close to this, what we're saying here. Yes?
The problem with most home inspectors, of one that I know personally, is that they miss a lot of things. Now, I can tell you for a fact that they miss a lot of these lamps.
Uh-huh.
So what happens with the contractor?
Alright, so this is the thing. If the owner is aware of a problem, and again, a significant problem, which is considered significant enough that had I known it, I wouldn't have purchased the house. So then it would seem that they can go back. Alright, let's move on to the case, another case posed by Cicero about the famine in Rhodes. Okay, David?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Suppose that there's a food shortage and famine in Rhodes, and the price of corn is extremely high. An honest man has brought the remains of a large stock of corn from Alexandria. He's aware that a number of other traders are on their way from Alexandria. He has seen their ships making for Rhodes for substantial cargoes of grain. Ought he tell the remains this, or is he to say nothing and sell his stock at the best price he can get? I'm assuming he is an enlightened, honest person. I'm asking you to consider the deliberation and self-searching of a sort of man who would not keep the remains in ignorance. He thought that this would be dishonest, but who is not certain that dishonesty would be involved. In cases of this kind, that eminent, respected Stoic Diogenes of Babylonian habituality takes one side, and his very clever pupil, Antipater of Tarsus, the other. Antipater says that all the facts must be revealed, and the purchaser must be as fully informed as the seller. According to Diogenes, on the other hand, the seller must declare the defects of his wares as far as the law of the land requires, but otherwise, provided he tells no one to exceed, he is entitled to the seller of goods to sell them as profitably as he can. I offer it as cheap as other dealers. When I am overstocked, whom am I cheap?
All right, we really are low on time, and I'm assuming there's many opinions on this as well. We will take just two or three. I know feelings on this matter. Is this any different than the house? How do you feel on this case? Does the seller of corn have an obligation to share that information? Wow.
Awesome. No,
sorry?
The market factors are different. The answer is the question was asked, is there a shortage of this anywhere else to see accepted information? But at the time of the sale, the supply and demand were different than the supply and demand upcoming.
Okay. Not a problem. He has no obligation to share the information. Anyone? Yes?
Well, it's sometimes what I do inside of trading.
Okay.
Because the person selling knows that the value of the stock is going to be substantially reduced when the market gets flooded.
Okay. So you feel that he has an obligation to share that information? Okay. Go ahead.
Well, does it fit into this law where it says one thing outwardly and otherwise in one's heart?
I don't know. That's a good question. Does it? A person doesn't have to say, you don't necessarily like the people who share everything they're thinking. So it's referring specifically to this food. Is this tricky? Is this trickery?
We don't know if the ships are going to make it.
Okay.
All
right. We don't know what's going to be. Okay. So maybe you should share that. There are boats on the way. They may or may not make it. So that would be, well, there's no question that if he did that, he's okay.
Right.
The question is if he doesn't say anything, is he all right?
Yeah.
So let's ask. All right. So what would it seem? Is it Kinei Vassas or Mecha Taos or Ona'a? Well, you would think that it is, right? You're stealing the person's money. They think this is valued at this price, and the truth is it's going to be valued a lot less tomorrow. Text number 6, though, goes to the Beit Yosef, the source of the Shulchan Aruch, Code of Jewish Law, and here we have the following rule. Page 16, Mr. Kraft.
Or that in the future it will be worth such and such. We only consider the current time and place.
Okay, so here we've just clearly differentiated between this case and the house. Right now the corn is worth this amount, right? I guess, based on the fact that right now this is all the corn in the country. So it would seem that it's not nevada, not intent to deceive, it's not a mistaken sale, and it may not be overpricing either. So that would seem to imply that as long as this is right now, what will happen in the future should not upset what happens right now. That would seem to be the rule. However, we have another case which may imply otherwise. Text 7a. I hope, by the way, I know we're moving along. I hope we've been clear. Has this generally been clear? Is there any certain areas of confusion? Yes.
Joseph knew there was a family coming for 7 years and used that knowledge to buy up the land.
Interesting. Okay. Well, it doesn't say anywhere that he didn't share that information. I think that people didn't know that. He purchased the land at full price at the time. Not necessarily without letting them know there was going to be a famine.
But they would have saved them. They wouldn't have. He knew ahead of time. He didn't share with them that it was coming so they could.
He may have shared. Okay. And you know what? Theoretically, you could probably assume that even if he shared, they probably wouldn't have believed him. They'd say, well, this is what's happening. They'd say, how do you know? Well, because the king had a dream. So you're also a believer in dreams. Here, I'll tell you this. No problem. So that's probably, I don't know exactly, but it doesn't say that he didn't share that information. Perhaps he did, perhaps didn't. But all right, let's move on to the next case.
Yeah.
Right. It does seem that people did know that. It does seem that way. All right. Text 7a. Go ahead, Dr. Rubin. You're up.
There was a food shortage in the Haridia. All the people sold their mansions in exchange for food. Eventually, we arrived. Rav Nachman said the law is that the homes must return to their owner. These were cases of the state that became apparent as the price of the sale. The ship, during the week, was standing in the side streams of the river right outside the city.
Okay. All right. So here, this seems to conflict the message we just said. That there's a food shortage, they sold their mansions, and he says you have to return the mansions. Which would imply, going back to the case of the corn, that would seem to imply, if we revisit it, that it is overpricing. Well, the food was nearby. The ships were standing in the side streams of the city. They were right outside the city. And the people weren't aware of that, and then when they would be brought ashore, the food price would go down.
The ship owner? The
commerce?
The people who
brought the... No, it doesn't say that.
Who
did they sell the mansion to? Anybody who had food. Maybe somebody who had a little bit more, and that's how they sold it. Nope, it doesn't seem to say that, yeah?
Only consider the current time and place.
It would seem to be that case. Yep. It would seem to be a contradiction.
It is part of the current time. That's just not known, but it's part of the
time. Okay, so the argument here is that it is the current time and place. All right, go ahead. But then going back to the corn, the case of the corn, did they have to share the knowledge that tomorrow there's going to be plenty of corn here? Okay. The person, he would definitely lose a tremendous amount of money by doing that. That's fine. That may be the right thing to do. It's not necessarily the smart thing. Maybe the right thing. Maybe the smart thing to do the right thing.
The houses,
but that's what we've already pointed out, that it's not only about that. even if the buyer and the seller both don't have the knowledge, there still could be a mistake in sale. So how would this it would seem to be that this is very similar to the case of the corn. But perhaps it is. But let's follow this. In a Shaila and Tshuva, a response by the called the Bochacha Rav, Rav Abraham Warman, the biography on the side on page 18. Let's see how he analyzes this circumstance. Text 7b. Page 18.
If the market price changes after a sale, an owner claim cannot be made as a result of this change. Some could ask regarding merchandise that was bought right before the delivery of a large quantity of additional stock from the side, which substantially reduced the market price. If the new shipment was already on the way to the market at the time the merchandise was bought, does ONA apply? They bring a proof that there is ONA in such a case by the in which we see that we had after the question was considered to have been in the city during the sale. The claim should therefore apply to this case.
Okay, in other words, what we said until now. What this last case of the ships and the wheat implies that if there is a large quantity of food on the way, it would disqualify the sale at a cheaper price. The corn, which was sold at an exorbitant price, should be returned and sold at the proper price. However, he says that is not necessarily the case. Text 8 brings a new halachic ruling which affects this discussion. Text 8.
If a lower birth person needs all his property for luxury, but needs some land for himself, his gift stands to the economy. If, however, he did not need any land for himself, the gift is nullified.
What was just said? There is in Judaism, there is this rule regarding what's called a shchiv meira, one who is on his deathbed. And when one is on their deathbed, so the there's a whole set of rules regarding one's words on their deathbed. And if they make a statement saying, I give all of my belongings away, and then they recover, then those belongings are returned. If they only give most or some of their belongings, then they recover, the belongings are not returned. And the reason is, as you see on the top of the board, there's umzinat demuchach, this clear assessment. If it is abundantly obvious that this action was done only on condition of a certain event that is about to be, then it becomes a clear assessment that this was only intended in the case of such and such. And this gift, the person doesn't give everything away unless they are assuming, and based on the circumstance, they are assuming that they're not going to survive. If they give most away, so even though it could be argued that in all likelihood they gave it away for that reason, but in all likelihood it's not enough to then return the object. So this is called when there's clear assessment, this was on such a condition, the rule is it can be returned. Based on this, if we visit the two situations of the purchase of the corn and the selling of the houses for wheat, he says one of them gives us clear assessment, the other doesn't. Clear assessment requires two reasons. Does it have umzana or not? He says the famine arose does not have umzana. The reason is as follows. He says in order for there to be umzana, it requires two elements to be taken into consideration. The actions and the circumstance. Two elements. So the action circumstances, going back to the person on their deathbed, the circumstances they're on their deathbed, and the action is selling, is giving away everything. And only when, if someone is healthy gives away everything, you can't assume. The person who was healthy assumed that they were going to die. Rather, the actions and the circumstance both together contribute to a clear assessment that this was done in condition of the following event. So he says like this. The selling of a home is such a unique action done in a circumstance where there's no food, that it's very clear nobody would sell their home unless they figured there is no food. It turns out there was food, there was food right nearby, so they wouldn't, the whole intent was only because there's no food. As opposed to purchasing corn, so yes, they overpaid for corn, but overpaying for corn is not something which is extremely unique. Overpaying for an item is done from time to time. And that's not strong enough to say that it was clearly intended only in such a circumstance. And being that it is not a clear intention, then we fall back on the previous principle, which is that when I disclose defects or I disclose information, I only have to disclose what is right now and right here. So again, I'll clarify that one more time. The reason why, the truth is, as we said earlier, the principle of I only have to share information of right now and right here. The house which is defected right now, right here. The fact that corn is coming, that's none of my business, that's not related to now and here. There is, the exception to that is when there's a clear umdin of the mucha. If it's clear based on an unusual action, based on an unusual circumstance. The person only did this. The person only gave away all their wealth because they assumed they would die. The person only sold, gave away their houses because they had no food. It turns out there is food. It turns out that they didn't die. In that circumstance, we have another reason to overturn the sale. And that would be the difference between these two cases.
So if someone forecloses on their house because they think the economy in Detroit was terrible and they didn't have a job, that's foreclosed. They decided to foreclose their house the next day.
That's because, you know, so each one of these circumstances has to be analyzed. That's why I don't believe anybody should foreclose their houses right now, so hopefully we won't deal with that. But the point is that in such an event, that would be, each situation has to be analyzed because a foreclosure of a house is not as extreme as selling a house for food. Although you can argue maybe it's very similar. Or a person on the deathbed giving away all their belongings. So that's why it has to be a radical act, not just an unusual act, but a radical act in order to have this new circumstance of umdana, a clear assessment where the sale is met on condition that the famine endures.
On the other hand, we can sure pray that the court opens to more
flesh. I think so. We've heard a lot of good news out of court recently, so we'll hope that will continue going. So this would be his conclusion in regards to this case. Now, we're going to, because we are literally out of time, we're going to skip the part regarding returning lost objects. Torah has a very strong sentence regarding returning objects. It's important to return someone's lost object, which may also influence this. We're going to skip that to conserve time. And we are going to conclude. First of all, so you have what Cicero concludes, text number 9, he says, I believe that the corn merchants ought not to have concealed the facts from the Rhodians, and the man who assigned the house should not have withheld its defects from the purchaser. Holding things back does not always amount to concealment, but it does when you want people for your own profit to be cast in the dark about something you know and would be useful for them to know. Anyone can see the sort of concealment this amounts to, and the sort of person who practices it. And wow, listen to this. Quite a description. It takes such a person to give his years. The reverse of open, straightforward, fair, and honest. He is shifty, deep, artful, treacherous, malevolent, underhand, sly, habitual, rogue. Surely one does not derive advantage from earning all those names and many more besides. So he gives lots of wonderful descriptions to such a person. He doesn't differentiate. The Torah does differentiate. It says that a person, and again, the person does not have an obligation to share all information regarding future or situations in somewhere else. I do have an obligation to share information of right here, right now. And when it comes to that obligation, Torah is very, very unique, very strong with regards to sharing the right here, right now to such a degree that if either of us don't really know what we're buying or selling, the whole sale is for naught. The whole sale can be turned over. Like we said, the situation in the antique, which I believe is a unique Torah approach to that. Now, again, there is no clear conclusion with regards to insider trading, but perhaps we can apply some of these and question whether it does or does not apply to insider trading today. Okay. So last, we have the chart on page 21. And let's see how we would apply the different rules we learned today, the Torah rules, with regards to insider trading. The first one is Gineivas Das, theft of mind. How it may apply to insider trading. So what could be more blemished item than a stock that is about to tumble? At the time of the sale, Stewart and Waxel already knew that the stock was blemished. By knowingly selling something that was blemished, they were misleading the buyers and are thereby guilty of Gineivas Das. On the other hand, while it may not apply, the buyer's decision to purchase has nothing to do with Stewart's and Waxel's decision to sell. In fact, If they wouldn't have bought her shares, they would have bought somewhere else. Can you say, can you be said to be misleading someone if they are going to take the same action? You're not misleading them. They would leave, they would call, they would do the same purchase regardless. Let's move on to Mekasas, mistaken sale. Again, it would seem it's a mistaken sale. The top, the stock is about to tumble. Such a stock perhaps should be subject to sale, should be subject to cancellation. Moreover, and this would seem strange, applying this logic would mean that all sales, even from those with no insider information, that occurred after the FDA's decision would be mekasas and reversible. You would say, perhaps, even if someone didn't know, even if the buyer and seller both weren't aware, it could be reversible. However, this may not apply because when someone buys normal merchandise, a car, a house, or a bottle of milk, they assume that the purchase is unblemished. In the stock market, there is a certain understanding that things rise and fall. Therefore, that's part of the calculation. So perhaps you can't call it a mistaken sale when my purchase is on the basis that it may rise and fall. That's part of the logistics of the stock market. How about ona'a, which was you're not allowed to sell something for more than a sixth above the market value. Again, the real price for the stock was much lower than what she sold it for. She sold it for $58.43 a share, but a little while over the course of time after the FDA's announcement canceling that drug, it was the share tumbled to less than $6. So obviously, it was well more than a sixth above the market value. But again, we mentioned earlier that that is something that would happen in the future. Question is it what is the value of it right now? Perhaps now it is valued at $58. And finally, umvena, which we take into account what is, seems to be the clear indication of what the person intended. You could say, obviously, a person would not buy something if they knew that it was going to tumble. They're only buying it with the intention that it won't tumble. But again, going back to the on the flip side of that would be that the stock market buyer is buying it with an awareness that it may go up and may go down. So, you know, the summary of all this is that we find a very strong sense of truth in Torah. Therefore, a buyer and a seller have to be very well aware of what they're purchasing and what they're selling. Otherwise, the sale can be canceled because of mekasas and mevasas. With regard to the situations in the future, and it is somewhat slippery. You know, if you say that a person has to notify the seller of whatever is going on around town, so if someone's selling an item in one store, so they have to tell you that, by the way, down the block, you can buy this for less. Is that an obligation? So this is an area which, if you do prohibit or obligate someone to share all information of other locations and future times, it would be very hard to exactly define that. But the point is that there is a difference, and there may not be an obligation to share what will be in the future, what is in another place. Having said all this, a person, we will go back to our original point, that when a man or woman, when they, at the end of life, they're asked, when they come to heaven, the first question is, were you honest and straightforward? And part of honesty is not only living by the letter of the law, but also by being kind-hearted and good to others. Following Satan was said by a prominent businessman, I think greed is healthy. You can be greedy and still feel good about yourself. It's an interesting statement. Do you agree with this? This statement was said by a man named Ivan Boesky, actually a Detroit-born person, who has been, so most of you are familiar, very good, then caught and sent to prison for insider trading. For men, it's hard not to pursue money. And they say that men are like bank accounts. Without money, they don't generate too much interest. So we have a hard time with it. But this is the greatest struggles in life, is the idea of honesty, but not only honesty, we're going beyond the letter of the law. But when it comes to this topic of insider trading, the different halakhic topics we mentioned before, there's different areas, and I will give there will be a short video, a 1-minute video, which goes over the key points we discussed. Perhaps you can draw your own conclusions. But going back to what we said, and this perhaps is most important we finish with, is that in this area, as a Jew, we are obligated to dino de mafusa dino, we must follow the rule of the land. And being that in America, and it is considered, it is prohibited, it is illegal, and as we heard earlier, it's not something you want to really mess with, so this would be the law of the land, and obviously it would be illegal. Just to conclude with the key points of this discussion.
A sale can be nullified if the product is defective or the merchant is unaware of its true value. Conducting such a sale intentionally is forbidden. The law of onana prohibits an individual from concluding a transaction at a price that's more favorable to himself than the competitive norm. A deviation from the market price of more than a sixth invalidates the sale, while a deviation of a sixth requires that the excess be returned. Onana only takes into account the current market price of that of a future date or another location. All stipulations in monetary matters are valid. However, a person must be informed of the extent of his loss in order to be able to forgive. At times, a stipulation can take effect without it being communicated. However, there must be a clear assessment based on the circumstances and the transaction that such a stipulation was intended. A person is obligated to save others from any financial loss. However, this obligation does not pertain if doing so will cause a loss of profit.
All right, well, that's the conclusion of today's topic. Next week, we will discuss the wages of the working poor, and we will hear first from the, Federal Judge Avram Cohn will be here to share some words before our class next week. All right, thank you very much. Again, pleasure to meet you, and hopefully I'll see you next week. Any questions or comments, you can email me or call me. I'd be glad to respond.